Wonderful to be with you for study of Bhagavad Gita. Each time I have the blessing to be with you for this, we have a short prayer and then I share a short review of Yogacharya O'Brien's previous teachings. I offer a few comments of my own and time allowing, we have space for your questions and comments. So let's begin with a centering moment. As we turn within in preparation for scripture study, we open our hearts and our minds to the indwelling Lord of Love, the source and substance of our being and of our innate wisdom. We offer our pranams, our respect and gratitude to all who have and do share these teachings on the Bhagavad Gita, especially to teachers in our lineage of Kriya Yoga. And we honor our own knowing. We open ourselves to having that revealed from within. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. We're still in Chapter 5 of Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga of Renunciation. And in this chapter, we come to understand that true renunciation is not a withdrawal from life. It is rather letting go of mistaken identity, the belief that we're limited to body and mind, driven by attraction and aversion, and conditioned by desire and fear. What is renounced is not action, but this misidentification. And then the question comes, what remains? The divine self. The divine self remains. The immortal essence of being, unchanging, still, ever present, the life of our life, the soul of our soul, the very ground of awareness remains. And this chapter continually returns us to really central questions for all spiritual seekers. Who am I? Roy would say, what am I? Who am I? What is God? And how shall I live? How shall I live this knowing? Verse 17 of chapter 5 tells us the answer is not merely to be understood, but it must be lived. It says, thinking of that, thinking of the divine, thinking of God, thinking of that, devoted to that, making that the supreme goal, this one reaches a state from which there is no return. This verse gives us instruction and a profound promise. There is a realization from which one does not return to forgetfulness. There is no return to forgetfulness. No more oscillating between God, 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 and me, me. No more going back and forth. Why? Because the very mechanism, the mechanisms that sustain the ego, attachment, aversion, compulsive desire, these have been dissolved through sadhana, through right living, through wisdom, insight, and through our deep meditation, super conscious meditation. Ego no longer defines identity. We have taken the reins back. When all conditioning falls away, consciousness then abides in its essential nature. This is freedom. The Yoga Sutra calls it Kaivalya. This is ultimate freedom, non-dual realization, no return to confusion. Verse 18 of chapter 5 then provides instruction for us. It says, and you will remember this if you heard Umaji teaching it last week. It says, the wise see with equal vision a learned person, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and even one considered an outcast. And you remember she shared how she was perplexed that they would put a dog down there as almost undesirable because of her dog. She's like, well, of course, that dog is divine, just like we are. But this verse is saying to us, this is having equal vision. Not as philosophy, but as direct perception. Knowing by knowing. Roy Eugene Davis translates chapter 5, verse 18 this way. This is a modern day way of saying it. Those who are spiritually awake see the same supreme consciousness in all people and all creatures. Without exception. That's pretty clear, isn't it? Those who are spiritually awake see the same supreme consciousness in all people and all creatures without exception. This verse challenges the mind's tendency to divide things up and to rank them. And to separate, higher and lower, worthy and unworthy. And if we reflect briefly, even, we may notice it can sometimes be easier to see the divine in a beloved animal than in a human being who we disagree with, whose actions we find disturbing. Harmful. So, how do we live this teaching? We begin with discernment, seeing the one, the capital O, seeing the one in all. It does not mean ignoring behavior. People act according to their conditioning and their karmic patterns. We are to respond wisely. We set boundaries where needed. But inwardly, we do not deny the truth about the one in all. That same divine consciousness lives in all. This practice transforms us. And boy, do we have an opportunity right now, don't we? I mean, in our own personal lives, but my goodness, in our nation and our world, to really live this teaching. This practice transforms us. First, it prevents us from becoming what we oppose. It keeps the heart open, the mind clear. It keeps our humility intact. It prevents us from becoming what we oppose. And then, secondly, it anchors us in deep faith. It anchors us in deep faith, this knowing that there are not two powers in this universe, good and evil. There are not two powers in this universe. There is only one reality appearing in many forms. Even in a world that appears fractured, the divine remains whole. Then in Verse 19 of chapter 5, it says, even here in this world, those established in equality conquer birth, rebirth. Even here in this world, those established in equality conquer rebirth. They are established in Brahman. This verse brings extraordinary encouragement. Even here, even now, liberation is not elsewhere, and it's not after death. Even here, even now, it's possible in this lifetime. So we ask ourselves, what is overcome? What is overcome to experience this? Not the world. The world is not overcome. Our misperception of it is overcome. Not the world, but our misperception of it. Through the vision of oneness, the errors of separation dissolve. And with them, fear, hatred, sorrow. To see the one and all is not abstract spirituality. It is the end of suffering. Just try that on in your imagination. What if there's no fear, there's no hatred, there's no sorrow? It is the end of suffering. Verse 20 of chapter 5 says, one should neither rejoice on obtaining the pleasant nor sorrow on obtaining the unpleasant. Such a one is established in God. This is equanimity. Not indifference, not numbness, but steadiness. We still feel, we still love, we still experience grief and joy. We have all of life, but we are no longer ruled by them. Right? We have those feelings. They don't have us. Why? Because we no longer assign our well-being to these changing conditions. Instead, we abide in remembrance of God. You know, like Brother Lawrence described, always practicing the presence of God. And as this remembrance deepens, life continues. But we're no longer tossed about by every wave that comes. We become inwardly stable. This is strength, and this is freedom. Verse 21 of chapter 5 says, when one is no longer attached to external contacts, when one is no longer attached to external contacts, one experiences the happiness that is the self. This is a crucial teaching. The joy of the self, the essence of being, the joy of the self is not emotional. It's not dependent on any circumstances. Yogacharya's guru, Ryujin Davis, defined this bliss as the perfect joy of self-knowing. The perfect joy of self-knowing. Emotions still continue. There will be moments of happiness, moments of sorrow. But beneath all of that is an unchanging awareness, self-knowing. That is spiritual bliss. We stop searching for God as something outside ourselves, and we come home to the divine essence that we already are. Umiji closed her teaching in the last session by something she recently wrote. She wrote, how strange we are to chase the light that shines within us. How strange we are to chase the light that shines within us. Sometimes we are like a kitten chasing a laser light on the carpet. Everything is illuminated by the one which we are, which we imagine we are always moving toward. We see the light reflected here and there and journey outward in search of ourselves, the source of joy, peace, and all knowledge. How strange we are to chase that light that shines within us. One light, one power, one presence, beyond sensory perception, but known to the soul. Behold the one in all. I decided to focus my reflections on verse 21 of chapter 5, the source of inner fulfillment. Here are two renderings of that. First, by Ryujin Davis. One whose happiness is not dependent on external contacts, you know, that means sensory input or mental input. One whose happiness is not dependent on external contacts finds joy in the self. Such a one, united with Brahman, enjoys imperishable happiness. Where do I sign? Eknath Eswaran offers a similar rendering. He wrote, "Those whose joy is not in the senses, but within, have found their divine self. They are established in perfect freedom." Eknath Eswaran, "Those whose joy is not in the senses, but is within, who have found their divine self, they are established in perfect freedom." I like this verse because it gives us both the promise and the instruction. You know, it goes directly to one of the most important questions of human life. Where does our happiness come from? And, you know, in today's world, we're constantly encouraged to look for it out there, outward, toward achievement. If I become this, if I get this title, this degree, this belt, this, you know, I will be happy. Or we look toward relationships. If this relationship is in this way, I will be happy. Or external stimulation. There are endless streams of information and distraction that it, I don't know, such a bizarre thing that we do as human beings. Who thinks we're going to be happy by watching the cat videos on our phone? These distractions, we're taught in subtle and overt ways that fulfillment is just beyond where we are now. You know, like a carrot out on a stick. We're almost there. Keep going. Keep trying harder. We're almost there. Meditate longer. You can earn it. We're almost there. Meditating longer is fine, by the way. Don't let go of that one. But it is not going to earn you what you are seeking. It is going to help reveal what's already there. You know, we're taught that in the next experience, in the next success, in the next moment of validation, oh, finally someone noticed, I'll be happy, I'll be secure. And yet we know from our own experience that even when we attain what we thought would satisfy us deeply, this sense of fulfillment is often very temporary. And this is not a failure of life. It's just a misunderstanding of where lasting joy is found. In this verse, Krishna refers to external contacts, and that is the meeting of the senses with the world. Pleasant experiences arise, unpleasant experiences arise. Have you noticed? And the mind, conditioned by habit, moves toward that which it likes and away from that which it doesn't like. This is the cycle, you know, sometimes we call it a pole dance. Just keep spinning around the same pole looking for something. And this cycle is described earlier in the Gita in chapter 2, verses 62 and 63, which I think are really foundational teachings for all of us. When a person dwells on sense objects, attachment arises. And remember, attachment is two sides of attachment, right? attachment to getting what we like, and also attachment, also known as aversion, from what we don't like. When a person dwells on sense objects, attachment arises. From attachment comes desire. And from desire comes anger, thwarted desire. You know, if you feel like you are frustrated, which is a, I think, a seed of anger, right? If we keep watering frustration, it blooms into anger. We can backtrace it. We can say, what is it that I want that I'm not getting? Frustration and anger come from thwarted desire. So we can backtrace. What is it that I'm not getting? Well, you know, I want this. I'm angry because there's a war. What is it I'm not getting? Peace. How can I get that peace from within instead of looking for it in the world? So keep backtracing. It doesn't mean that, as Uma's teaching said, that we just ignore behaviors that are going on. It doesn't mean that we go about life, you know, in some Pollyanna state, like, oh, everything's okay, there's only one. No. But if we're looking outside for that peace and security, we're giving our deepest power away. And when we do that, we cannot affect change in the world. You know, the earlier teaching that Uma offered that said, we will become that which we despise. If we're not anchored within, when we go to a march on a Saturday, for example, that kind of thing, we bring anger to fight anger. Now just think about that. We bring war to fight the possibility of war. This is so illogical, right? So what we need to bring is the truth of peace. And you can be, I just am remembering an experience I had many years ago, a few decades ago, actually. I was visiting a friend in the Berkeley Hills, and I just needed a moment alone. And so I went outside, and, you know, there were houses all around. And I just stood by her little hill in her backyard that had a little bit of grass, a little small yard. And a baby deer, a little fawn, walked right up to me. And I was just, you know, you can imagine what you feel like when that happens. And then the mother came. And so there was this fierceness in the mother that wasn't attacking me, but she was taking a stance. This is mine and I will protect it. How do we bring that power? How do we bring that same, do you understand what I'm saying? That same power, how do we bring that? When we are in that sense of being attached to what we want and having desire arise and then anger arise, this outward movement of attention, of our attention, creates a life that's dependent on circumstances. It gives our power away. Our peace is not dependent on what is going on in our family, in our relationship, in our community, in our nation, in our world. Our peace is not dependent on that. In a world like ours that has uncertainty and rapid change and, a sense, I would say, of collective unrest, this dependency can become a source of instability. But this verse offers a turning point. One whose happiness is not dependent on external contacts. Again, this does not mean withdrawal from life or refusing to engage in relationships or responsibilities. No, it means shifting the center of gravity of our awareness. Instead of looking outward for fulfillment, we rest in awareness of our essence of being. And in our Kriya tradition, this is a lived experiential reality. This is what we're called to do. This is what the world needs from us through our meditation, through our practices that we have been given in this lineage that keep us connected to the core, to the source. Through our interiorization of our attention, we begin to study, to discover that there is a quiet, steady presence within us that is unmoved, even by great personal loss. We may have deep sorrow, right? But we still know there's an anchor that's not disturbed by changing conditions. It's not diminished by loss. And it's not inflated by success. It just is. Paramahansa Yogananda wrote, this is paraphrased from his book, Where There Is Light. The happiness of one who depends on external conditions is uncertain. But the happiness of one who lives from within is unshakable. This teaching is especially relevant for our time. We're living in this world that there's social and political division. There's global conflict. For many, there's personal uncertainty. And if our sense of well-being depends entirely on what's happening out there, we find ourselves continually unsettled. You know what I'm saying? I think you do. But when we learn, even in small moments, to return our awareness inward to the presence of being itself, we begin to observe and experience a different type of stability. And this is not indifference, it's not disengagement, it is bringing a grounded presence. From this place, we can act. We can serve, we can love, we can respond to the needs of the world without being overwhelmed by it. And this verse concludes by saying, such a one, united with Brahman, enjoys imperishable happiness. Now, imperishable happiness does not mean constant emotional pleasure. It refers to a deeper state, a quiet contentment, a sense of completeness. The carrot has been eaten. It's no longer in front of us. It's a deep knowing of our essential nature. Roy Eugene Davis wrote that self-realization, or that realization of the self, reveals the innate wholeness and sufficiency of our being. Realization of the self reveals the innate wholeness and sufficiency of our being. This is a happiness that does not come and go, you know, because it's not produced by outer circumstances. It's a happiness that's uncovered. I mean, just think about it. We can be really upset about something in our relationship, in our family, in our world. We can be really upset about a loss, or really elated about a supposed gain. But when we have deep, deep meditation, all of that dissolves and we become anchored in a true, deep peace. So, how do we live this teaching? Very simply and very profoundly. And you know, I like lists. So here are 4 points. One, notice where you are seeking fulfillment. Notice where you are seeking fulfillment. Just gently observe. Am I looking outward for something to complete me? You know, oh, when this happens in my relationship, everything will be okay. Or with my work or with my world, whatever it is. Notice where you're seeking fulfillment. Number two, practice returning inward. And we all do this every morning, and many of us in the evening. But how do we do it throughout the day? How do we practice the presence of God throughout the day? Practice returning inward, you know, through meditation, through conscious breathing. Before you read the news feed or watch the news or whatever it is you do, or have a meeting with your family member, your relationship person, or whatever, your job, breathe. Take three complete belly breaths. You can even do it in the meeting. We're breathing anyway. So bring our attention to conscious breathing. Invite stillness. You know, let your awareness settle back into a witnessing presence. One, notice where you are seeking fulfillment. Two, practice returning inward. Three, pause in the midst of experience. Even in activity, when you are being active, take a moment to feel, I am here, awake and aware, present. I love doing this when hiking. I mean, it's really easy then, right? You're out in nature. But sometimes your mind, when you're on a nice hike, can still be going, right? Well, I'm going to use this time to contemplate this thing about work or whatever. Can really, your mind can be spinning, but I love just stopping and inviting myself to witness the entire experience. Like a higher form, deeper form of metacogitating, watching my being experience it. And we can do that at any time. Notice where you're seeking fulfillment. Practice returning inward. Number three, pause in the midst of experience. If you're in a difficult meeting, just excuse yourself. Say, oh, I need to use the restroom. Get up and go to the restroom. Pause if you need to. And then number four, favorite one, let joy arise from being itself. Capital B. Let joy arise from being itself, not from what is happening, but from the fact of awareness itself. Wow! Look at this awareness that is allowing me to experience and express in this realm. Wow! I'm visiting family right now, and you know, we hear these teachings over and over and over years, and each time they seem new. I just had a conversation with a family member about that very topic. You know, how do we approach end of life with that kind of consciousness? That's a big question. And it was a moment. Wow, I never thought of that. Don't worry, everything's okay. It's just a conversation, being able to have that conversation. So this verse, verse 20, 21 of chapter 5, it's simple. It reminds us, you know this, that what we are seeking is not somewhere else. That's it. It's not some future condition. It's not, it's thank goodness, it's not dependent on the world aligning with our preferences. Thank goodness. It's already present at the very essence of our being. And through our practice, through devotion, through our seva, through steady inward turning, we come to know this directly. And it never leaves us. That is the promise. Okay, that was a lot because we got some extra stories in there. But I'd love to hear from you on reflections about this very promising verse or Uma's teachings. What's happening? Are these teachings, do they feel relevant? Hi, Sakshi.
Oh, what was the page number
Oh.
on the?
Oh, hold on. I have to turn my volume down. I don't know how. One moment. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
What was the page number on Where There Is Light?
Oh, I have to look it up.
Okay.
Let me make a note. I'll do it and send it to you. But it's a paraphrase.
Okay.
Not a direct quote. Hi, Barbara. Oh, was there more, Shlapchi?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Nice to see you.
Hi, good
to
morning.
See you.
Hi, Barbara.
I loved something you said. I'll try to paraphrase it, and I may have already lost it, in which case you can say it again. But this distinction between maybe happiness and the joy that is our foundational essence of being. And I think sometimes when we are, wanting joy in very important, substantial things, we should want joy with, like our relationships with family or the work that we do, especially if our work is meaningful. I think sometimes I still am sort of thinking that the finding of that joy is going to be the emotion of happiness, and it's just something so much more deeply, profoundly, it's more than an emotion. So thank you for that insight.
Okay, there we go. I'm back. Yes, and thank you, Barbara. I often think about, I have this photo in my meditation chapel at home. It's a photo of Baba Hari Das from Mount Madonna offering ashes of one of his most beloved devotees into the Ganges. And in the photo, and so this was a great, great loss for him in with that devotee, obviously, right? If he took her ashes to the Ganges. And in that photo, I can actually see and like feel his sense of inner joy, even in that time of deep sorrow. So it's such a beautiful reminder that, the happiness we're seeking is a bliss that's much deeper.
If I might say one more thing, just as you started to talk, I kind of had this insight, and I feel like your example illustrated it. It's that the joy is its wholeness, its fullness, and fullness is like the yin and yang of life, or the, it's the sorrow and the joy together. It's something so much richer.
Exactly. Exactly. We can't have one without the other. Right? We can't have light without darkness. We wouldn't be able to see the light. We can't have darkness without light. Hi, Saraswati. I saw you leaning in. Oh, I can't hear you. You're unmuted. Maybe you have the wrong mic chosen. There you go.
Can you hear me now? We had an external speaker plugged in. What I was going to say was, this is hard. Because, when, especially like something like relationships, I mean, a thing, like a new car or what, whatever, it's one thing, but yeah, it gives us temporary happiness, and then we, get a scratch on it and we're unhappy. But relationships are hard. And, we put, especially close relationships, family, where we're expecting or hoping or thinking that it should be different. And so it's hard. That's all I'm, that's all I can say about it. And that these teachings are really, I mean, to have this foundation of these teachings from the Gita and Kriya Yoga help us get through that. But it's conscious work to keep coming back. Oh, yeah, teachings. Oh, yeah, the teachings.
Thank you for that. Relationships are, this isn't quite the right word, but such a profound playground for our spiritual awakening. Such a profound support because of that intimacy. And We're taught in meditation to we have a beautiful meditation, and we're taught don't look for that same experience again in meditation. Right? We can't recreate it. Don't look for that experience again. And one of the reasons is that there's something even better than that experience that we'll miss if we're attached to it being a certain way. Just look in your own practice and see if that's there. And I love how Roy always asked us, instructed us, guided us to employ curiosity. Both in meditation, but in our life, to be curious about, what is it in this moment of tension, difficulty, loss, joy in our relationships? What is it that is trying to reveal itself? What's being drawn from me that's a higher good? It requires faith, like Uma said in her teachings. Yeah. Lots of people were nodding. I don't know if you saw them when you said, yeah, relationships are an interesting place to play this drama. Hi, Mangala.
There we go. Hi. One of the things that you said just really hit is realizing the attachment that I have to wanting our country to be back where it was 10 years ago. But, just the it, I have a hard time leaving go of that attachment, and I'm really going to have to contemplate how that's playing out, especially with Saturday coming up, to be able to put out my best piece.
Yeah. You're not alone in that one. And, if we really think deeply, 10 years ago, we just had other things in our country that we didn't like. And 10 years ago, there was this faction of our country that was unsettled, but it was there and it was beneath the surface. Like a pimple trying to raise up to be released. It has to come out of the darkness, this a anything that has a, what we would say like an ugliness or a it's just an unsettled, faction. It has to come into the light to be transformed. 10 years ago, that was not in the light. It was there. It was there, that movement that took us where we are now in our country. It was there, but it was there since slavery. Let's put it that way. But it was hidden. It was in the darkness. Occasionally came to light. Now it is really out there. It is really out there. So we can take the same longer view. Be curious. Wow, our country is not going to be the same. But it's not even going to go back to where it was 10 years ago. It's going to be much better than that. It's going to be much better. We're just in the phase of that pimple getting popped. It's ugly and it's unpleasant.
Yeah, through our whole history from the Mayflower has
Correct.
that.
Correct. And it's been underground. And it has now come to light. And, so we need to participate in that healing. So we're bringing the light to it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
If we become part of the shadow and the darkness, it does not help it. We can't push it back down. We don't really want to, right?
No.
Let's just pluck it out.
Great.
It's like a it's not like it, it is a national samskara. We have our personal samskaras, seeds that were planted in our consciousness through actions and thoughts. This is a samskara of our nation. And samskaras have to come to light to be uprooted. Right? When the conditions are ripe, it will be revealed. The conditions are ripe.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're all in that question. I'm so glad you voiced it. We're all in that question. And wow, look at our team bringing light, either by bringing our body to a march or being at home saying prayers, whatever it is we're doing, whether our body's there, our consciousness is bringing light to it. This is a powerful team. And we're just a small part of it, the team. Lilia, are you raising your hand?
Yes.
Wonderful. Hi.
Hi. Thank you again for the beautiful teachings. Following on Mangala, this is teaching us humility, because we keep saying and hearing from politicians and everybody, we are not that kind of people. This is happening, but we are not that kind of people. This cannot be happening here. And also, to me, it brought it to personal, because sometimes, I never will do that. Oh, I never, Well, guess what? Given the opportunity, I will be worse than anyone in prison now. So humility, I think, is what is teaching me that, yes, we are that kind of people, and yes, I can do that too.
It's so true, isn't it? We don't think of our country like, oh, that's a third world country problem. Yeah, no. It's a human problem. Before we close, I want to inform you or remind you that tomorrow evening, where's Prabhama? Did I get it right? Maybe they got logged out. Sumati, is that right? Tomorrow evening is, Friday. Tomorrow evening, Friday, we'll have a celebration of Roy's life. It's the anniversary of his Mahasamadhi, his conscious transition from his physical body and mind. And Acharya Atma, Prabhama, Krishna Das, and others will have chanting with Dave and Shri. So it'll be a beautiful opportunity to come together in person or online. Is it at, give me a thumbs up, is it at 6?
Yes.
6 to 7:30?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, wonderful. Is Prabhama saying something?
Oh no, I'm just confirming. I didn't know if you could see us or not, so.
Hi.
Hello.
Wonderful. So I'm thinking of you all, and I know, tomorrow, Friday night, could be a nice way to anchor yourself, especially those who are planning to do something on Saturday. I know that's a big day. Even if what you're going to do is stay home and pray or deal with your own family, Friday evening can help be a big anchor for us. So I look forward to seeing you all soon. Uma will be back to lead meditation and offer Gita study next Thursday. Om. Have a beautiful day.
Thank you.
Nice to see you, Bob and Nancy. Love seeing all these people from Nina. Kamal and Obi. Always great to see you, Obi. You up in the mountains still? Foothills? Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Hi, Vandana. Oh, Sherry and Denny. Yeah, they are here. Wow. Sakshi, I'm not too far from you. I'm in Spokane and then over in Coeur d'Alene. Yeah, 30 degrees here this morning. All right. Now, Sumati, you're going to have to cut all of that off the recording. The audio. Okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye.